I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of native people is going to occur. Krejci now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for long-term memory radio. A four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory radio.
In 1884, the federal government of Canada asserted that they aimed to, quote, make Indians white men in the eyes of the law, end quote. Fast forward to 2002, and some would say that little has changed. The current federal government will be seeking to replace the Indian Act with the First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act. While the Canadian government is seeking final solutions to unresolved Aboriginal treaties and other issues, the lack of consultation with Natives and the focus on passing federal legislation leave some asking, are First Nations ready for the drastic redefinition of their rights and powers as this country's original peoples and owners? This four-part series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project is dedicated to discussing the issues around the federal government's latest attempt to redefine its, and subsequently the Canadian people's, relationship with our Aboriginal neighbors. Part 1 will bring the Indian Act and the current legislation into focus. Part 2 includes a discussion about Native resistance movements and the media's systematically poor coverage of Native issues. Part 3 is dedicated to understanding how the Canadian government's policies have impacted Aboriginal women. And Part 4 will be produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio on this station. On the line with us now is Andrea Moore, and Andrea lives in Ganawage, which is 10 minutes from downtown Montreal. There, she struggles for individual rights and women's rights within the Ganawage community. Andrea, one of the reasons we have you on the line today is to talk about the Indian Act, and particularly its impacts on Aboriginal women. And I'm wondering, when the Indian Act was imposed in 1874, there were several things that that the federal government was trying to get control over, namely how membership would be defined within Aboriginal communities. It also tried to impose a particular style of government later on with the band council system, but there were also the residential schools. What were the impacts within the community of Ganawage? What was happening there when the Indian Act was enforced?
Well, with the introduction of the Indian Act, you had a traditional government that was in place at the time, which governed the people. And we had our own structure, whereby it was a matriarchal system, whereby it was the women who passed down the lineage to the children. And who also had title to the land, who took care of the longhouses and took care of the families, and each longhouse had, which was representative of a clan, or of a family. It was the women who held, was the head of the household of the longhouse. And with the introduction of the Indian Act, this eliminated all of their roles and their responsibilities, and took everything basically away from them. The Indian Act basically said that the women no longer had title to land. It could only be men that held title. The women no longer passed on their lineage to their children, according to the Indian Act, and it was turned to the male. In other words, if in the paternalistic or in a patrilineal system, you see that the man would pass down his last name to his children. In a traditional system, it was the woman who passed down her clan system, her clan to her children. And that happens, and that continues today, whereby you have clans that still exist today, where it's the women who are passing down. However, they still take on first and last names in terms of a paternalistic perspective. And what it basically did was is it basically eliminated the women's roles and their responsibilities towards the nation or towards the Confederacy and towards the people in the community.
In the band council system itself, when it came into effect, it was supposed to outlaw this traditional matriarchal style of government in which the women were sort of at the top or one of the key figures in this style of government. But you say that it's continuing even to today?
Yes, what happened was is the traditionalists at the time with the introduction of the Indian Act found that they had to go underground, and that's what happened with the introduction of Catholicism and the Jesuits who came to Europe at the time. With the introduction of Catholicism being in the community and the introduction of the Indian Act and all the different foreign aspects of us, of our society at the time, were basically dictating to us that we could no longer practice our tradition, our customs, and our beliefs. So what happened as a result of this is the tradition went underground. We had to go underground in order to survive or to keep the traditional tradition going. And one of the things that was that composed of was is that you weren't allowed to talk Mohawk in the home, because the Catholic religion said that we were no longer allowed to talk Mohawk in order to better to integrate us into civilization and to get us to become as they were as well, being a colonist society. So you had the traditional people going underground. You had the introduction of the Indian Act, whereby your band council system was an elective system that was introduced, whereas in a traditional aspect, it was all only through consensus. And with the introduction of that Indian Act, you also had the representatives of only being men. Men could only be the ones that were being elected because they were chiefs. And according to the traditional system, women could not be chiefs. So it was a totally foreign entity to us at that time, because you had traditional people whereby it was the chiefs that were sitting in the place, but it was women who put them actually there. And then with the traditional side of the thing, with the Indian Act side of things, it was only men who could hold those seats and make decisions and be taking over both roles, as both as you could say as a clan mother's role as well as a chief, but eliminating the clan mother completely. So this is where you had your traditional people being forced to go underground because they weren't allowed to practice the tradition anymore.
Well, the Indian Affairs Department itself is currently facing more than 200 court cases challenging the Indian Act, and most of them are from women. So I wonder if you can talk a bit now about your first introduction to protesting and struggling against the government. What was happening in the 1970s in the Ganawage community, and how were women organizing to protest against the Indian Act, and what were they protesting?
In the 1970s, you had many years of having the Indian Act that was basically destroying the Aboriginal people, and particularly, it was disrupting Aboriginal people within Ganawage, particularly, speaking from my perspective. And in the 70s, what was happening is women from across Canada were being evicted from their homes, and their children were being evicted as well. And the communities were going in at the time and taking over their homes and their lands. And this was going on in other areas of Quebec. Particularly in Quebec, they tried doing it here in Ganawage, but the women had to actually stand up and make a stand and to protect themselves, because they were being evicted from their homes and from everything that they understood, based on what the Indian Act was stating and dictating to the population at the time. And in the 70s, there was protests that were going on, and myself, as I was young at the time, we did go to Parliament Hill to demonstrate against the discrimination of the Bill C-30, of the Section 12-1B of the Indian Act, and how women were losing everything, how they were losing their homes, they were being forced to leave their communities, They were being cut off from their communities because of what the Indian Act was doing to the women. And at, whereby at the same time that this was going on, the men within the communities were marrying non-Native women. Because of our actual physical location as to where we are, being next to a major international city, we were very much in contact with the outside world, or the outside, or other nations, you could say, or other peoples at the time. And there was nothing wrong for the men to marry out of the community or marry out of being Mohawk people. And what was happening was, is these women were also able to, not only they gained status, so now you had non-Native women that were being recognized as Natives, and they were having children, and their children were being recognized. Whereas the Native women who were marrying non-Native men were being thrown out. So there was women being thrown out, men that were being accepted and maintained their status, and were having marriages with non-Native women, and they were being recognized. So with this parallel process going on, eventually, down the line, you would see where there would be less and less, a bloodline with Mohawk people, and this is where it was starting to become eliminated. So in the 1970s, the women basically were saying, no more, we've had enough. Why is it that the men can do this and the women can, and yet where is the equality within the system? And there was no equality. There was no equality anywhere within the system because of what the intent of the Indian Act was meant to do to the to Aboriginal people. And the women just got fed up, and they said, enough is enough. These are our homes you're taking us out of. And people were literally being dragged out of their homes and being escorted to the boundaries of their reserves and being told that they had to leave and that they weren't welcome back anymore because of what their family life situation was, whereas the men had no problem. They could walk into those specific homes and say, okay, this is my new home, and the women had no say. So basically the women were being put out on the street, and the men were walking in and saying, thank you very much. See, it was drastic times that was happening. And I mean, people, the women were looking at being the caregivers of their homes and being responsible for their children, and they were finding that they were being left out on the street. So the inequality was rampant. Mind you, in Ganawage, the women basically put up a fight and said that they weren't leaving and had support within the community. So there was a lot of defiance that was going on, and this is what pushed the women to go to Ottawa to protest, was the discrimination that was going on. Particularly, there was a strong women's movement during that time for women's equality, women's justice that was going on during that time, and the women in Aboriginal world just said, well, we're tired of being thrown out of our homes. And so the women decided to get together, and they went up onto Parliament Hill, namely specifically Quebec Native women took a strong role in that position to support the women throughout Quebec and to get them back into their homes and back on their communities. This was everything and anything that they understood, so it was being eliminated. And so you had the struggle happening right from the start, because the women said enough is enough. And that's why you had your protests happening on Parliament Hill.
And what came out of that? What came out of those demonstrations at Parliament?
Well, out of those demonstrations, you had the introduction to Bill C-31 in 1985 as a result of the women's push and the struggle to get their recognition. And that's what happened in the introduction of Bill C-31. It changed Section 12-1B of the Indian Act, whereby the women were able now to return back to those communities, to their communities, particularly the women who married out. And they says, okay, the law says that the women could be returned. The women were able to return, but what happened was, is in order to allow some time to have the band councils in the communities accept those women back, they also told that the band councils had up to 2 years to make a membership code at the time that would be non-discriminatory, in by which the children could be returned. And a lot of band councils throughout Canada had no problem with this. A lot of the band councils or the communities throughout Canada accepted their women back, and still today the women have returned home and are entitled to all full benefits and access to programs and services that are available in their communities as everybody else's, as an equal. However, Ganawaga continued to defy that, because one of the things that Ganawaga did was never create a membership code. And because the membership code wasn't created, the Department of Indian Affairs said, well, whatever we say as the government, after 2 years, if you cannot come up with a membership code, what the department has to say will apply on reserve. 2 years came and went, and Ganawaga never came up with a membership code that was non-discriminatory towards Aboriginal population. Therefore, by law, the children are legally entitled to go back to the communities. However, Ganawaga continues to defy the law and say, no, that not only the children can't come home, nor can those women who were thrown off. And what happened was, is my mother at one point, when the law changed, she called Band Council office asking them if she was able to return. And one of the questions was, is your husband dead? And she said, well, no, my husband is, as a matter of fact, he's very alive and healthy. They said, well, are you divorced or separated from him? She said, no. They said, well, sorry, you're not entitled to come back to the community. So Ganawaga continued to defy those laws, and still today, 17 years after the amendments to the Indian Act, continue to defy those laws. So you still have that same struggle going on because of the band council system not accepting those women back, in which is ironic, because they are the ones that actually represent that system whereby you're supposed to be able to come back to your community. There's a catch-22 there. Either they're not letting you in, so you're not able to come home, so you're being stuck on the outside.
Women's current struggles today against this continued defiance, what's happening within women's organizing in Ganawaga today?
Because you have an introduction of what's going on right now in Ganawaga, where you have a Canada-Ganawaga relations agreement, whereby Ganawaga, or the band council system, is looking at leaving the department's or the Indian Act method with the introduction of this agreement, whereby you're going to have an introduction to a new government of Ganawaga, which is something totally foreign. This is in the eyes of self-governance, or in the push towards self-governance for Aboriginal people. And the Department of Indian Affairs has gone into negotiations with Ganawaga to eliminate the process whereby the Indian Act applies on reserve. But the women in the community and individuals within the community are seeing what this agreement is about and the effects that it can have in a long-term process. Let's not forget that in a traditional aspect, within the tradition, we believe that we should be looking out for seven generations ahead, not what happens with us today. So with keeping in the mind of what's happening within seven generations, of how this document would affect our children and future generations, individuals within the community have come out and said, no, this is not a good agreement. And what's happening is that the longhouses have basically said to the council to walk away from the negotiation table, and they still continue to negotiate. So who the council does actually representative of is a small minority of people within the community, and the larger number or the larger masses of the community are saying, no, you know, this is not a good agreement, and yet they still continue to negotiate, despite the traditional people or the longhouses saying, walk away from the negotiation table. Different individuals coming out and talking about the agreement and saying that, no, it's not a good agreement, with all the negative statements that are coming out of this agreement. Aboriginal people or the people in Ganawaga are saying this is not a good agreement, yet Ganawaga or the council still continues to negotiate despite what the population is saying.
Well, Andrea, we're going to take a little break and come back and talk more about the current struggles in Ganawaga, particularly around this so-called elimination of the Indian Act. So talk a bit more about that when we come back from the break. Welcome back to part three of this four-part series on the Indian Act. And with us today is Andrea Moore. Andrea Moore lives in Ganawage, which is just 10 minutes from downtown Montreal. And there she's struggling for individual as well as women's rights in the Ganawage community. Andrea, right now we're talking about the Canada-Ganawage relations process. And this grew out of community outcry over RCMP and SQ raids in 1988, as well as subsequent state force that came into the Ganawage community and disrupted the community there. Can you talk a bit about what this current process to redefine the relationship between Ganawage and the Canadian government grew out of?
During the late 80s and the early 90s, you had, most of the late 80s that were... You did have the RCMP and the SQ coming into Ganawage and raiding different businesses in the community, and the people had no warning. We were basically saying that they had no jurisdiction because of the fact that Ganawage was considered to be a territory according to traditional people. And they were just coming in and they were just raiding and arresting the people and our people and taking them away and basically throwing the books at them. When the people felt that they were basically exercising their rights as First Nations people within Canadian and North American context, based on our rights and our jurisdictions according to the traditional government and who we are as a nation or as a people. And what happened was, is at the time the with these raids coming on, you had the introduction or a mandate that was given from the people to push towards the traditional government, whereby that they could say to the outside governments, you know, like, you have no more jurisdiction here, you have no more authority here. In other words, keep the RCMP and the SQ out of here, because there was a lot of animosity and a lot of problems in the past where you had an SQ officer killing and murdering, actually, you could say it's murder, a person in the community in his front yard. And there always has been a big struggle between the Mohawk people and the Sept-States Quebec, the SQ. And then what happened was, is in the late 80s, you had the introduction of the RCMP coming in, and that we're enforcing federal laws here because we are considered to be federal agents, or federal responsibility, and federal responsibilities. And so you had the RCMP now coming in. So now you had two different forces that were walking into communities, and the people were sitting back and saying, well, why are we having these foreign governments coming in and enforcing their laws on us when we have our own laws? And there is where you had your introduction and your push towards our own peacekeepers, which are our local police here, to enforce the laws in our community and have Aboriginal people taking care of themselves. And out of this grew what you could see as coming from today as being the CKR agreement, this Canada-Ganawage Relations Agreement, whereby it's the introduction to the elimination of what the Indian Act has done and can do to the population and which the people have had enough of the Indian Act, because don't forget that this Indian Act was imposed on the people. They had no choice but to abide what the Indian Act was saying. And so now the people people today are saying, we don't want it anymore. We've been telling you from day one that we don't want it. So with that in mind, what the council has done is they've come up with their own form of agreement whereby it would eliminate different processes or different aspects of the Indian Act that affect us on reserve.
Well, let's talk about that. Who exactly is involved in the negotiations around the Canada-Ganawage relations process? Also, what are they negotiating? What all is on the table?
That's actually a really good question, because right now the negotiations, who's in negotiations is the Department of Indian Affairs. There is a negotiating team that's been developed or that grew out of this, and also the council, the Mohawk Council of Ganawage, where you have... which is called the Intergovernmental Relations Team, whereby they're communicating with each other on the terms in which they're going to decide on how they're going to self-govern, how self-governance will apply. So with this agreement in place, you have a structure that's been created whereby you have an umbrella agreement where it gives a very light overview of what Ganawage is looking to have responsibilities over. And within that umbrella agreement, you have four sub-agreements. And the four sub-agreements poses of membership, jurisdiction, education and culture, and land states or lands and allotments. The thing that's really interesting about this agreement and where we have as a problem with and other women have a problem with, where we basically all have a problem with, is that what's going to go to Parliament and what's going to be decided in order to introduce this law will be, or this agreement between Ganawaga and the Canadian government, is only the umbrella agreement. So which is the top portion of the agreement, the top portion only. And Ganawaga is going to go in and they're going to recreate all of, they're going to be responsible for their membership, their land, their education and culture, as well as jurisdiction. This will not be subjected to parliamentary debate. The only thing that will be subjected to parliamentary debate is the umbrella agreement. And within the umbrella agreement, there is no meat and potatoes to the agreement. It's very vague in which Ganawaga is going after. So people are sitting back and saying, well, okay, if this is what's going to parliament, it's basically washing the responsibility of the department's hands of Aboriginal people, particularly of Mohawks, and their responsibility towards us. They're washing their hands of their responsibilities to us, whereby it's also taking on Ganawaga's more authority in order to continue to perpetuate the elimination of the Aboriginal people within the community, or Mohawks within the community, particularly under the membership issue. And so you have both pushing towards the same goal, but for different reasons. And so now we're saying, as women that are sitting around and individuals within the community are sitting back and saying, well, hey, what are you doing here? Hold on a second. You're pushing this too fast, because what are you actually saying and doing to us? You know, and they said that this has been in the works for a long time, for many, many years, and it's like, well, why is it that the people are being introduced to this so quickly and saying they don't even actually really understand what the fine line details of what the agreement are about? So it's both the federal government, or the Department of Indian Affairs, is pushing to have this agreement go through, because it alleviates their responsibilities towards Mohawk people. Band Council system is pushing to have the introduction to this, because it will introduce the introduction of a government of Ganawaga, which is definitely completely, totally foreign to what traditional people understand as being what the mandate is supposed to be, that they were mandated to go into talks for self-governance under a Ganarakoa, which is a traditional law, the great law to the people. So you have an introduction of a third law that's coming. And people are saying, what's going on? They were not mandated to negotiate for this. They were not mandated to negotiate for a traditional government, not a new, completely new government that's being introduced under the CKR agreement.
Just to clear that up, you said that they weren't mandated to negotiate for that style of government. They're actually mandated to negotiate for traditional style of government.
Yes, they were. The people wanted the people to talk about, the people of the community, because of the raids that were going on in the 80s, they said enough was enough, and they wanted the band councils to go back to a traditional government. They said, we have our own government, we have our own laws, and our own ways of living and doing our ways, of being who we are as Mohawk people. So basically the people told the councils, you got to return to that traditional government. So what the band council did was, is they interpreted this and pushed towards self-governance. And this is what that the people are pushing towards as well, but in a traditional context, not as an introduction to a whole new form of government. And this is what's being introduced under the CKR agreement. And the Department of Indian Affairs doesn't have a problem with whatever form of self-negotiations there or self-governance that they want to go for, as long as they're alleviated of their responsibilities towards the Indians. See, basically, they want to get rid of the Indian problem. They don't want to keep us as basically, quote and unquote, children, because we are basically wards of the Queen.
Perhaps that's why on the government's website, the Ministry of Indian Affairs quotes both Robert Nault, Minister Nault, and Grand Chief Norton of Ganawaga as praising this new relations process. It seems like it's not really going to change anything except make the band council give that system more stability.
What it's going to do is it's going to give more powers to the band council, more to the band council, or the Mohawk Council of Ganawaga, the MCK, or the new form of government, which is supposed to be a government of Ganawaga, because let's not forget, the MCK will wind up becoming abolished, because it does no longer represent the Department of Indian Affairs, so you no longer have a band council system that's going to be in place. It's going to eliminate that. You're going to have the introduction of a new form of government, which is going to be the government of Gunawagan. Now, with them pushing towards this, both are getting rid of their... One is alleviating their responsibilities by the Department of Indian Affairs. Gunawaga is taking on more responsibilities and will be no longer subjected to all the rules and the criteria which the Department of Indian Affairs is pushing, which works very well for the new, well, what we understand today is the MCK. They will be able to create their own membership, and membership is a big factor on how the people are going to, well, what's going to happen. You know, membership is the foundation to all. And the council will then be able to create and to introduce their own membership code at this time. And it won't be subjected to the criteria in which the department has set forth already. So it will give them the authority and the power to create Aboriginal people or to make the decision on who is a Mohawk and who is not. And basically what they've done to this point is they've devised a process whereby they eliminate the population. They have basically taken on the same job as what the Department of Indian Affairs has done since the beginning of time, whereby they're trying to find ways to eliminate the population. You want to get rid of your Mohawk people. So now the council is basically taking over the same process, and they're saying, okay, well, let's get rid of all the Mohawks, and then we'll have more for ourselves in the end, particularly the land and the programs and services that are available that Aboriginal people are entitled to.
Wendra, let's talk about how all of this struggle over what form of government will exist in Gunawaga, or at least that the Canadian government will recognize. What's the impact on the community itself, the people?
There's a number, the message or the way it's going to impact the people is so immense that I could go through each point within the agreement on how it's going to affect the people, on what's been presented to the community thus far. One of the things is that Gunawaga, with them taking over their membership, the new form of government is going to decide on who is a Mohawk and who isn't. Now, you have a lot of intermarriage that has gone on within the community because of what the Indian Act has done to the population. And what they have done in the laws that they have created today, or that still stand for today, where it eliminates a large portion of the people. You also have jurisdiction. See, membership is the foundation to it all. Okay, once you have your decide on who's your population in terms of who is a Mohawk and who isn't, according to the way this, with which they have not come out with a membership code at this time either. They have not come up with a membership code whereby everybody can agree on, and they still have problems with that today. So whatever it is that they come out with, that's what one of the suggestions I made at the table was, is that instead of having a membership code that eliminates the population, why don't you have one that's an inclusive one? But apparently there's a problem in the community because the land base is not big enough to accommodate the population if they were to accept another 2,000 people back, another set of 2,000 people back to the community. So there's a problem. It comes basically down to land, a land problem, and they're saying that there's not enough land for the population to accommodate another 2,000 people. So there's that that's in mind, and then you have also your jurisdiction. Let's say, for example, to give you a case scenario, whereby you have an individual who's recognized by the council, okay, who has membership for whatever reason, who's entitled in the community no matter what. And you have a scenario whereby you die. And if in the event that you die, your estate, your will is subjected to the approval of the new form of government, and they will decide in the end who will be entitled to what. For example, if an individual who's recognized by the community wants to pass their land and their house down to a person whom the council or the new government of Gunawaga doesn't recognize, they will walk in and they have the authority. The government of Gunawaga at that time, or this new supposed government of Gunawaga, will have the authority to walk in and say, no, you're not entitled to this. You, because we do not recognize you, therefore you are not going to get this. And then it becomes a communal, or it belongs to the population, it belongs to the new government of Gunawaga. It no longer can go to that individual who the estate says that it goes to. And that goes with anything else, with land, housing, and you can even go as far as your bank accounts, and even if you're, for example, you have a will and you don't have a named beneficiary, you just say it goes to the estate. At this point, the council can then, or the government can then come in and take over the estate as well. So you have the administration of lands and estates going on, and they will have the authority to walk in and take control over this. So no longer do you have, as an individual, have a say on who's going to be entitled to your property or to your estate at all. They will have that authority to walk in and say, sorry, you're not entitled to it, for the new person to come along, or whoever the said beneficiary is, if they're not recognized by the council. Then you have a case scenario if you decide to fight this on a jurisdictional level. If you decide as an individual that you're not satisfied with the decision that's made and you decide to take it to the court, to a court system, you can take it to a court, but you're forced now, under the new system that's been devised, you're forced to take it to a court of Ganawage, where the person that will be hearing this will be a judge, which is supposed to be, which in reality is a justice of the peace. Whether if a justice of the peace has the education, the knowledge, the experiences, and the understandings on to make a decision and to make a judgment in a judge's capacity is subject to anybody's critique at that point to decide on whether if you think that JP has that authority to do that. But this is who you're going to be presenting your case in front of. And this JP or this judge is going to be the one that's going to be upholding these laws for the new government of Ganawage. So with you pleading your case, you basically, right from the beginning, have no equality or no justice within the system. Now, if you, whatever the judgment is comes out to be, you can then appeal that decision. And where you go to appeal that decision, under the agreement, it's not stipulated on where you can or can't go. It's not clear. But if I decided to take it out to an outside court, where I bring it to, let's say, a provincial court system, or if I decide to go to the Supreme Court of Canada, any of those court systems on the outside could turn around and say, sorry, we don't have jurisdiction over there. You've got to go back to Ganawage and fight that out.
Well, Andrea, we're going to take a brief break for a moment here and come back and talk more about how you are planning to resist this as an individual who's struggling for rights within the Ganawage community. Again, this is just 10 minutes outside of Montreal and over 100 years of repercussions from the original Indian Act when it was initiated in 1874. We'll be right back. So welcome back to our conversation with Andrea Moore. We've been talking about her current struggles within the community of Ganawage, which again is only 10 minutes from Montreal, and talking a lot about how the Canadian government is currently engaging in trying to renegotiate its relationship with Ganawage. Andrea, how many people live in Ganawage?
I would say at this time approximately 6,000, maybe anywhere between 5,000 and 6,000 people.
And about how many people in all are members of the Ganawage community, including those who live off?
Well, that depends on where you're looking at. Within Ganawage, their membership list consists of approximately 6,000 people, whereas the Department of Indian Affairs is just over 8,000 people. So it depends on who you're looking at as having membership. This is one, as I said before, the biggest decision or the biggest deciding factor on who is an Indian and who isn't. So it depends on where you're looking at.
And that's obviously one of the issues that's currently being resisted today. The Mohawk Council itself, where do they exist in terms of opposition within the community? Is there any official opposition to the Mohawk Council of Ganawage?
No, there is no form of opposition. Even with the introduction to this new form of government, the government of Ganawage, there is no introduction or form of a opposition whereby within the, let's say, for example, in the House of Commons, you have the governing body where you have an opposition and you have a whip that's in place that keeps the governing house or the elected house in check and with their responsibilities and obligations. Whereas with the councils or the band council system that you have today, there is no opposition and there is no form of a whip in order to keep the councils in line and what their responsibilities are towards the people. And even with the introduction of the CKR agreement, with the new form of government, there is also, once again, no opposition that's in place. And there's nothing that will keep this governing body in place. So where you have your democracy is questionable. I question that because within a Canadian context, you have a democracy where you have opposition in the House, whereas in Ganawage, it's not there. There's only one power, one governing power, and the only way that you can make your changes is by getting with the new bank council system, well, with the bank council system, is becoming elected into that position. And that's even just as much a complicated process in itself because of the lack of people that actually come out to vote. Whereas in a traditional concept or just traditional aspect, you have the longhouses whereby you have people that are coming to a decision based on consensus where they all agree 100% unanimously on what the solution is or what the method or the action will be. So you have more of a democratic process where you could say in a traditional aspect, whereas compared to what the band council system has done to this day and what they're introducing as well for the future. So your democracy is not there. So it's the voting is not the same process, and there's no saying on who's going to do what, where, and when. You know, there's no opposition to the process at all.
Well, there's many democracies around the world that have problems with voting. I mean, obviously, the United States, in its most recent presidential election, had a huge dispute over who actually won and what percentage of the population was represented in the victory. Within the community of Ganawage, the current Mohawk Council, where do they exist in terms of community support? How many people voted for them in the last election?
Well, approximately 1,000 people voted in the last election, and with 1,000 people who are going out to actually vote for a band council system in the community, it's questionable as to whether if they're actually legitimate in terms of their representation of the population, because it's obvious that they don't represent the population at this point. Whether if your population is 6,000 or 8,000, if you're only having 1,000 people that are going out to vote, it's questionable as if they're actually representative. And the people in the community choose not to vote because the majority of the population are traditional and don't believe in a voting system. Myself, personally, I've never voted myself, and I'm in my early 30s now, and I've never voted a day in my life. That's even on the outside in a provincial or a municipal or even in a federal context. I've never voted, and nor do I plan on voting ever. Because it's not a process in which I believe. It's a matter of the will of the people that's more important on whether if one person gets an actual paper where they can mark their X on. You know, it's the issue that's most important.
In terms of your resistance, the election system obviously is not going to be the route that you go. You're not going to choose that as your method for resisting the Canadian Ganawage relations process, or even, you know, the current repercussions of the Indian Act as it stands today. Exactly how are you going to approach this in terms of changing, making effective social change in your community?
Well, there's three processes or three levels that I've been looking at or the possibility. One of the processes is actually talking in the community and coming out into the community to discuss the issue. Because let's not forget, if the community decides that they feel that what's going on is not good for the community, the people will come out. They will come out and talk out about the issue, and they will come out and they will say, no more, enough is enough. They do, and they have in the past. And you also have your, I also have the process whereby I'm also speaking with the chief negotiators for the CQR agreement and telling them of all the things that are going on in the community on a daily basis. Now, you have the federal government listening to only one side, of which is which the band council is, and they're painting a real rosy picture as to how things are in the community. But they're not seeing the realities of what's actually going on a daily basis from a person who's not respected or not does not is not recognized from a band council or from the band council here for their membership code or what they considered as having membership. So you, with us going into those tables or going to the table and telling the Canadian government that they have to maintain their responsibilities, if there is going to be a law that applies or if there is a law that does apply to the community, well, then apply your law. If you're not going to apply, then get out completely and let us take over in a traditional government. It's one or the other. It cannot be an medium method to get to that tradition, because the tradition is already there. And if it means going to protest on Parliament Hill, I'm prepared to go protest on Parliament Hill. If it means having to have meetings and request meetings with different members of the Senate, I'll be prepared to do that. If it means taking it to court and fighting it in a court system whereby it's saying it's an illegal process, I'm prepared to do that. Whatever it takes to stop this process from going on, because it's eliminating the people, and you don't eliminate your people. That's not a process whereby we understand as a traditional government where it increases your nationhood. It's eliminating your nation. And that's not the whole process whereby. So what basically the council is doing is they're taking over and doing the job of the federal government that has done since day one, that they're just doing it in their own way.
What were the intentions of the Indian Act in the beginning and for all these years and continuing today under the band council system?
Well, under the band council system you have today, where they continue to eliminate those women that are considered to be non-status women because they've married out and had children and they're not recognized within the community. Let's not forget, these are the women that actually hold clans, that have clans from a traditional aspect. And these are the very people that they're trying to eliminate and will eliminate, and their children, namely and more specifically their children. Being a second-generation child myself, myself not having a clan because of what my history runs, I will admit that I don't have a clan, but I have... I know of people whereby they do have clans, but their children or their children's children will not be recognized, even though they may have a clan, because of the way the new system that they're proposing to be devised as, from what we can understand of what a potential membership code could be, even though there's not one that's actually written in stone and what the criteria is as of this day, 17 years, and they still don't have a membership code. So it's questionable, and what's even more questionable is why are you looking at eliminating those women and their children, you know, when they are the ones that hold clans under a traditional aspect, and that's a traditional form of government in which the council has been mandated to go towards. So they're eliminating all those people. And even under our great law, under the Gonaragoa, whether if you have a clan or not, if you decide to take hold of the roots under the tradition and seek shelter under the Tree of Peace, you will be protected. And it's not happening. It does not happen today. And you have those women that are holding that title or that bloodline, and they're looking at the possibility of having their children eliminated. They, not so much today, but that's what I'm saying, looking seven generations ahead, their children will be eliminated. Their future generations will be eliminated. Within three generations, you're going to have a major cut population. So it's pretty much, it's scary to see what the potential is on this. And my plan on going forth on it is to I've gone into the community, I've spoken publicly in the community based on the issue and explaining to the people what the implications of what some of the implications could be. And also I'm prepared, as I said, I've spoken with the federal government and I've told them what they're doing is wrong, because I basically told the federal negotiator that they don't have a right to negotiate my rights or any women's rights away as Aboriginal people. They don't have that right to do that. And I said, as a Canadian person or as a Canadian individual, I said, who gave you that right to negotiate my rights away? You don't have that authority by any means. So based on that, why are you still negotiating? I said, you don't have the right to negotiate my rights away. You don't have that right. And they continue to do that. And this is what they're told that they're mandated to do. So I have a big problem with what the federal government is doing as well, because they're sitting into negotiating my rights away, and they have never asked me on how I feel about it. And yet I come back and I tell them, no, you don't have that right, yet they still continue to negotiate my rights away.
Well, just to bring it back to the federal government's website, on the site itself, there's a quote from NALT that says that, our intention in negotiating these agreements, meaning the Canada and Ganawage relations process agreements, is to establish a new relation based on trust and mutual respect, and therefore to displace the application of the Indian Act. And after that, there's a mention that the consultation process will be as broad and as inclusive as possible.
Well, that's what's being said to the public, but what are the realities? The thing is to have a new negotiation process, to walk into new negotiation processes. I mean, is the minister prepared to eliminate my rights and walk away my rights because he doesn't want to see what the fine line details are going to be within the community, how it's going to affect me if he decides to go through with pushing forth with self-governance? You know, what is the criteria? And that's what we're one of the things that we're asking for is that this be included in the umbrella agreement, that women's rights are not negotiable. You know, if they're willing to push that the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is going to be applicable on reserve, which I'm kind of leery of to begin with, yet they're saying this is one of the main criteria, like, well, okay, let's have women's rights as being the main criteria as well. But yet they sit back and they say, no, it's all up for negotiation. And I'm saying, well, who's negotiating for who here now at this point?
The only reason I bring up the website is because the terms in which it's couched, it seems like you're up against a huge PR campaign, public relations campaign by the Ministry of Indian Affairs, as well as by the Band Council system itself.
Yes, we are, because what's happening is the Band Council system, despite everything that's going on, there's a consultation process going on right now in Ganawage. And Ganawage has chosen not to consult those women who are not being recognized, or those individuals who are not recognized according to the Band Council, and have left the responsibility to the federal government to go out and seek out those people, to consult with them, and what they find out, to get their opinion and expressions about this agreement. Now, Ganawage has only recognized, because they're only recognizing a small minority of the population, they are only consulting those people. Now, what do they consider as being a consultation? If the traditional people are telling them to walk away from the table, when they walk in the door, they are being escorted to the door just as fast. And they're saying, leave. You are not negotiating on our behalf. Yet they go to the federal government and say, well, we consulted the Longhouse people. Well, okay, you walked in, you consulted them, you've done your job, you walked through the door. But how long did you actually consult? What was said? What's the outcome? Well, you were escorted to the door. That's the reality. What they're being told, the federal government, is that they were consulted. So now I'm questioning what's the validity of the consultation process that's going on. Is the truth coming out? And then also what they've done is they've left the responsibility of the federal government to go out and seek and find all those individual people to consult with them on the outside who have not been recognized by the council. And a lot of these individuals have decided to, because, well, they're not recognized by their community, they pack up and they leave. Now, Mohawk people, everybody knows in the community, we could be found anywhere in the world. I mean, we have, I can find Mohawk people anywhere in the U.S., in the West, all over North America, as well as Europe. I mean, there are Aboriginal or Mohawk people that are around the world. Now, they've left this responsibility to the federal government to try and get in contact with these people.
Something the federal government had never done since day one, consult with Aboriginal people.
Exactly. But the thing is they're trying to consult with people whom they don't even know where their whereabouts are. You know, you have a lot of iron workers and people that are working in the States who have left. You have a lot of people that are living out west in BC, you know, all across Canada, who've decided to pack up and move someplace else for whatever their reasons is, if they want to create a better lifestyle for themselves because of the way the lifestyle is here in the community. You know, they've left that responsibility to the Canadian or the federal government to go out there and find them. They're saying, well, good luck in your consultation. Yeah, we're going to consult here in Ganawagan. The other thing that I have a question about, what I was questioning was, is that as a federal government, I says, you are here as a negotiator to consult with us to get our opinions and our perspective on the issue. I says, and there is a representative here from the IRT group, which is the Intergovernmental Relations Team, acting as a resource person. I said, however, I says, when the consultation process is going on in Ganawaga, in the community, for the people that are recognized by the band, or the Mohawk Council of Ganawaga, I asked the negotiators, I said, are you there at those consultation meetings to be asked questions by the people directly? They said no. So what Ganawaga has done is the Mohawk Council has done, is they've eliminated the federal government from walking in on these consultation processes. And we're also told as a group of women, you know, well, we can't be guaranteed that you'll be able to stay in those meetings because you're not recognized by the council. According to the council, you don't have membership, therefore you're not entitled. But yet they're negotiating my rights away at the same time. So I have a lot of problems with the process and which is what's going on and what's up for negotiation. And this is why I've sought out legal counsel. I've had Quebec Native women support us completely, 100%. I made a presentation to, or not necessarily me, but me and the group of women have sought out the help of Quebec Native women because of what's at stake. And this is exactly what Quebec Native women was originated and created for, was to fight for women's rights. And now the women of Ganawaga are back to square one, right from the beginning, even though that the processes or the laws are still there. So everything is at stake once again.
Well, Andrea, if anybody wants to stay up to date in terms of what's happening at Ganawaga, or they just want to inform their own resistance, where do they go?
Well, there's a couple of places. One you can find out through the Mohawk Council of Ganawaga, or the Ganawaga has a website where you can, if you just look up Ganawaga or Mohawk Council of Ganawaga, you can find the CKR agreement there as it is, from what I understand. How recent it is, I don't know. The other place you can look up information is with the Eastern Door, and I believe they have a website today as well. And there's other Mohawk newspapers that should be listed in the websites as well on the net. But there is actual information out there, and there is ways you can find out stuff, as well as through looking up at the Department of Indian Affairs if they actually have anything on the website about the CKR process from their perspective. I don't know from the federal perspective, but I know that the federal government does have a website with the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs Development, or DIAND.
And I did pull some information off of the federal government's website. If you just look up Canada-Ganawaga relations, you'll pull up some information there. Just to follow up on what you said, the Mohawk Council of Ganawaga's website can be found at ganawaga.com. That's www.kahnawake.com. www.ganawaga.com. And the Eastern Door paper that Andrea mentioned can also be found on the web at www.easterndoor.com. That's EASTERNDOOR.COM. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's been an excellent conversation, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future and possibly even interviewing you live on Parliament Hill.
That would be an interesting sight.
Thank you so
much.
And
I look forward to it as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of Native people is going to occur. Krechen now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for Long-Term Memory Radio, a four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America, every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory, radio.